C'est un grand honneur d'être ici. Et maintenant, je parle en anglais. I think it will be easier for you to understand me in English than if I murder the French language. So I will continue, not only to break the linguistic rules, but also to not follow my colleagues in looking at the past so much as to looking at the present. Attempting to understand what has been going on in America, and then seeing the connections between that and perhaps what may be going on in France in a few days' time, and what happened in my native country with Brexit. Here we go, anyway. Attempting to understand the appeal of Donald Trump, and by implication, the wider global trends that may include France after the second round of your elections on May the 7th, is clearly the type of question that Idrik was designed to explore. Let me focus on America, because it is here that I have spent most of the last three decades, in Washington, D.C. and in Boston, after my very valuable stay at Idrik during 1985 and 1986. You see, you never taught me French properly. Whatever they may tell you now with the benefit of hindsight, nobody really expected Trump to win. Not even the candidate himself fully realized the success he had had in tapping into a reservoir of anger and frustration that enabled him to defy all the predictions and gain enough votes to become the 45th President of the United States. The shock of his victory has resulted in a much needed reassessment of politics in America, as well as many other societies in the contemporary world. Was this part of a massive vote against globalization and neoliberal economic policies? But if so, why trust a billionaire whose global financial dealings read like a poster child for the very policies that the sense of outrage and protest is supposedly about? Was it a belated racist and xenophobic backlash after 8 years of having a black man in the White House? But time and again, so many Trump voters, drawn from the typical white working class Democratic camp, had twice voted for Barack Obama in the two previous presidential elections, hardly the record of hardcore racists. To say that Trump's campaign was unorthodox is, to put it mildly, an understatement. Of the 17 Republican candidates, he was helped by being the only one who was not a politician, although his campaign rhetoric broke all the rules normally associated with successful candidates. Open attacks on Mexican-American immigrants, stereotyping them as muggers and rapists, demanding a halt to Muslim migrants and refugees, portrayed as a major source of terrorist attacks, openly contradicting the pronouncements of Pope Francis on building bridges rather than walls between people, which might normally have antagonized millions of Catholic voters. His statements and behavior towards women, suggesting a strongly chauvinistic demeanor, if not an outright sexual predator, and potentially alienating more than half the electorate at the very time that his opponent was the first female candidate for the position. All these factors would have destroyed a candidate in previous elections. And yet, despite getting 3 million votes less than Hillary Clinton, he was able to secure a solid majority in the electoral college and thereby win the election. It is one of the interesting twists to this unique drama that those who are trying to understand it have had to stray outside the comfortable intellectual circles in order to provide a plausible answer. In listening to one exploratory attempt to do this by a political scientist, I was amazed to hear her citing the work of Pierre Bourdieu as perhaps shedding more light on these relevant issues than most standard political science theories. Donald Trump's political appeal is difficult to classify in a simple fashion. The rallying cry to make America great again is a common theme in many other societies caught in the grip of populist nationalism. How else can one explain the remarkable popularity of Vladimir Putin, whose military actions appear more important to the typical Russian than the dire state of their economy? Ethno-symbolism is one way of looking at the deeper roots of some nationalist sentiments, and in many cases provides some more nuanced interpretation of what is going on. The complexity and variety of the forms that nationalism assumes are fully acknowledged if one looks at the myriad examples of these types of identity through both an historical and comparative lens. So where does Trump and current populist nationalist trends fit into this wider picture? David Runciman has argued in a recent essay in the London Review of Books called Tocqueville to Trump that this event may well represent the beginning of the collapse of Western democracy itself. Taking the long durée perspective on the ebb and flow of democratic processes, Runciman raises the interesting but uncomfortable notion that just like so many earlier systems of government, the greatest threat to any regime is not outside enemies, but internal decay from forces within the community itself. Starting from the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, Deng Xiaoping's reversal of Maoist economics with the famous slogan, "To be rich is glorious," which sounds more like Donald Trump than Karl Marx, and the apparent triumph of neoliberal regimes over more socially egalitarian alternatives, for some, the end of history became the mantra of a globalized group of elites worshipping the market as a quasi-religious symbol, but acting as a smokescreen to obscure the blatant disregard for true market forces under monopoly capitalism. The gap between the super rich and the poorer masses of the rest of the population was starkly demonstrated before the Davos gathering of world business and political elites in January of this year. The top eight wealthiest billionaires on the planet owned more assets than the bottom 3.6 billion people, confirming that inequality is continuing to rise and threaten to lead to seismic political change. In the words of one of the members of Oxfam International, inequality is trapping hundreds of millions in poverty. It is fracturing our societies and undermining democracy. Such a diagnosis is not confined to global disparities that have always been considerable, but can be seen in the long-term trends in American society itself. While public attention in the United States has been focused on promoting democracy in the Middle East, the Bush-Blair strategy, you might call it, much less concern has been given to the health of democracy at home. The proliferation of lobbyists on K Street, or the relentless movements towards a plutocracy, aided by the Citizens United ruling of the Supreme Court in January 2010, undermining democratic decision-making in a quieter but just as effective manner as the democratic decision-making in other parts of the world. This last measure opened the floodgates of outside money into the political system, using the farcical argument that money was simply an extension of free speech, and that bribery and corruption could only be prosecuted if pursued in an entirely open and blatant manner. The inspiration behind this decision was the late Justice Antonin Scalia, whose name now adorns the law school at George Mason University, the university in Virginia that I joined on my return to America in 1988. You can imagine there's been correspondence between me and my former colleagues about this event. It is perhaps no surprise that there is a current revival of interest in George Orwell's writings, and particularly his novel 1984, among many disturbed by these trends in American politics. Another approach to explaining the phenomenon of Donald Trump has been proposed by Berkeley sociologist Arlie Hochschild, whose detailed research on the Tea Party movement over the past 5 years has sought to better understand the thinking of the supporters of the political right wing of the Republican Party. Based on research in rural Louisiana, some of the poorest areas of contemporary America, and often dismissed and stereotyped by so-called liberal media and liberal academics as the land of rednecks and ignorant, bigoted Southerners, reveals a much more complicated picture in reality. The title of Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, which was published by Princeton last year, captures the alienation and insecurity of sections of the country that seem to have been passed over by the American dream. And much the same picture emerges from ethnographic fieldwork studies in other parts of the country, as for example, Catherine Kramer's recent research in rural Wisconsin, described in her book, The Politics of Resentment. The insecurity in these geographical locations extends even to those who would generally be categorized as middle class. I won't go into the former type of American exceptionalism we often use to classify both Warren Buffett and his secretary as both belonging to the same class. But the insecurity of many people that are reasonably secure in the American system is undermined by constant encounters with the casualties of economic change. Kathleen McNamara writes, and she's a political economist, daily interactions with trailer park dwellers with missing teeth and broken homes leads many to fear that they are but one step away from economic insolvency and the shame of welfare. Such a prospect is part of the insecurity that Trump's campaign so successfully exploited. The steady proliferation of these concerns has created an enormous sense of resentment among those living in the growth, against those living in the growth economies of the cities and the coasts. Many people living in less prosperous regions see themselves as being ignored by distant elites who despise them as small town, ignorant religious bigots. And this, of course, is so very different from the normal acceptance of the American dream, where almost everyone believed they could be successful in a golden age of economic growth, provided they were hardworking and never gave up trying. Until recently, few Americans fully appreciated the comedian George Carlin's joke. They call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. Now the reality of American society for so many living in rural small town settings throughout the Midwest and the South, or in the economically depleted Rust Belt where manufacturing used to provide steady, well-paid jobs for those with only a high school education, is beginning to sink in. Even the ever-escalating costs of higher public education, as state budget support is reduced by fiscally conservative state legislatures, has increasingly acted as a class filter rather than as a ladder for social mobility. Private higher education is even more obscenely expensive, so that students who understand that qualifications are a vital prerequisite for entry into the knowledge economy borrow money to finance their education and graduate with mountains of debt that has grown to unprecedented levels. By January 2017, this had risen to $1.2 trillion, eclipsing auto loans and credit card debt, and only exceeded by home mortgages. No wonder the lobbyists for banking and finance companies who service this debt make sure that students, unlike insolvent business entrepreneurs, among which President Trump is a fine example, could almost never declare bankruptcy in order to avoid repayment. For most people, this is debt for life. How to recapture the promise of the American dream for those largely excluded from it was a key question in the 2016 presidential campaign. Two possibilities faced the American electorate towards the end of the debates. Donald Trump's vision of national greatness built on America First platform, blaming foreigners and minorities for many of the country's current problems, reverting to a manufacturing base built on protectionism and tariff walls. The other vision, just as surprising given the political traditions of 20th century America, was the social democratic platform of Senator Bernie Sanders. That a socialist could ever be considered as a serious contender for the presidency is remarkable enough. Not to mention all the other reasons why America is terrified of socialism. But as we know, Sanders, despite considerable popular support, could not get the Democratic Party establishment to rally behind him, and his nomination failed. Left with only one candidate representing an outright affront to the political establishment, the backlash protest vote and its strategic location was enough to give Trump the presidency. For how long his base supporters will stay loyal to their decision, particularly when we consider that they will almost certainly be among the principal losers from his so-called health care reform attempts, if they are ever passed, and the proposed new budget tax priorities remains to be seen. At the moment, Trump's approval rating remains at a historic low for a first-term president, in the low 40s of the percent of the American people, according to most opinion polls, and he has barely completed his first 100 days of his term. But these are early days, and in politics, anything can happen. Warfare with North Korea or Iran are two possibilities for improving his support in the short run, but they are dangerous strategies for making an unpopular president acceptable to the wider American public. Patriotism helped George W. Bush get a second term after 9/11 and the initial war in Iraq. But eventually Bush left office with some of the poorest ratings in recent history amid a collapsing economy and two seemingly endless military conflicts. Will populist nationalism last long enough to allow Trump to pursue his vision of making America great again, or will he sink into oblivion along with Trump University, Trump Airlines, and so many Trump casinos? Only time will tell. Thank you very much, and apologies for delivering in English.